it's the story. It's always the story. It's been the primary focus. And it started out with an idea for a story of a, and I thought a short story, of a young woman who was living with these people who were different. And I wasn't thinking, you know, superficial, like color of hair or eye or skin, but, you know, substantially different, but people. And I wasn't even sure where I was writing about or what I was writing about. But I got into the encyclopedia and I discovered, oh, yeah, there was Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon, and they were living side by side for, well, in Israel for 60,000 years, but in Europe for at least 10, 15,000 years. So, you know, they had to know each other. But that doesn't mean that they didn't necessarily try to avoid each other, too, because there was such a small population of people at that time. But I didn't realize that until I got into it. But I was just thinking about people who were different. And then I started reading in the encyclopedia, and I discovered, as I say, the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon. And then I got into more of it, and after the encyclopedia, I had a few names, you know, a few words. I could look up Lower Pleistocene, Upper Paleolithic, and had a few other names like Mousterian, which is a word that's used for the tool technology of Neanderthals. So it's used as sort of a shortcut word, you know. Once you get into the field, you begin to understand the jargon.
Well, what would you say were some of the characteristic differences between those two cultures at that time?
Well, you know, what we do have is we have the fossils, right? The fossils show the body was not that different. I mean, the Neanderthals tended to be smaller and very, very strong-boned. They were probably, as I've read, three or four times stronger than we are. But, you know, the men might have been 5'6". The Cro-Magnon men were like, you know, my character of Jandalar, 6'5", and that's based on the actual skeleton that came from the site of Cro-Magnon. They were tall, they were still pretty sturdy people, but tall, strong, handsome, modern humans. It was just interesting to, you know, to start reading about it, and here there actually was people who were living contemporaneously, and they were different. I remember reading about, you know, one of the original storyline was that when this girl who was living with them, you know, they were different. But, of course, they thought she was the one who was different. So they were looking at her with some suspicion. But she was taking care of an old man with a crippled arm, and so that's why they were letting her stay. And then I read about the second or third book. I went to the library then after the encyclopedia. And I came home with about 45, 50 books somewhere around in there. I don't think a library will let you check out that many books these days. But I checked out. You know, I was there for hours. And they were all different kind of things. I mean, just what happened to appeal to me. Some of them were very technical archaeology books. Some of them were books about people who happened to live with Eskimos or people who happened to live with other native peoples. There were books about animals and, like, you know, Elsa the lion, and then there was another book called The White Lions of Timbavati, you could see them. I mean, they weren't as well camouflaged as the typical tawny lions. So there were just different, you know, all different kinds of things like that. And I had, by the time I picked up the first one and got 10 pages into it, I was taking notes. Because the more I read, the more the story idea grew.
Is it true that even before you had really finished the first story that became Clan of the Cave Bear, that you already had projected a 6-novel arc?
Oh, yeah. Because what I did was I was just writing. I ended up with almost 500,000 words. And when I went back to read it, it was terrible. It was so... Because, you know, I was saying, this happened, and this happens, and this. In other words, I was telling and not showing. You know, the thing of it is I've been a reader all my life, and I realized that this was a terrible book, but I also realized that I had this passion inside me that I wanted to tell the story. So I said, okay, I have to learn how to write fiction. So I got books from the library on how to write fiction, and I remember reading some of my children's English, you know, would tell you how to look for certain things in stories and what were characters and so on, and that helped. And finally, I got to a stage where I felt like I knew what I needed to do. And so then I went back and started rewriting. And it was when I got to that stage, you know, I thought I was going to take this big, long mass of things and cut it all down to a book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, instead, it kept growing because as I was putting in the dialogue and the description and the kinds of things that it would take to make a story, it just kept growing. The thing had fallen into about 5 or 6 parts, and I was about halfway through the first part, and I realized I was going to have more than one book. And I told my husband, I've got 6 books. And he said, you've never written one book, but now you're telling me you're going to write 6? I said, yeah, it's a 6-book series. And that's what, you know, that was all part of the same. I needed to get that story told. I mean, Ayla was 5 when the story begins. She's 27 at the end of the 6th book.
And what would be the life expectancy for a young woman living Ayla's life?
Well, at that stage, it depended. You know, there might have been dangerous times, but these were modern humans, and they could easily live to 60, unless something happened. But basically, you know, they were pretty healthy people. It wasn't until agriculture that we really started to get unhealthier. The diet got too limited. You know, you start just living on grain. That's fine, but it's not enough. You need more vitamins than that.
What for you remains the greatest unanswered question about early human life?
Well, I have no doubt that, especially the Cro-Magnon, they were ourselves. So the difference between them and ourselves was the kind of world they lived in. You know, it was fresher, it was newer. They were living as hunter-gatherers. You know, that's why I've tried to learn how to do things the way the hunter-gatherers did. You know, I've napped an arrow point. Not that it was very good, but I did it because I wanted to know what it was like. I've never really hunted an animal, but I have taken the skins of animals that have been hunted and turned them into leather. Beautiful, soft buckskin. It's wonderful. You use the brains of the animal as the softening agent. I don't know who figured that one out in the first place, but it must have been genius. I don't know what I still have to learn. I think when I get to the place where I'm writing about it, that's, you know, normally I do a lot of research and then I start writing, and I become so accustomed to it. I've read so much, I feel it so much, that I don't have to stop very often and look things up. I know it. Except then when I do, you know, I kind of hesitate. Oh, I don't want to stop, but I really have to look that up. And I finally do. And then I always find something more than I expected to find. And it adds to the story. So, as I say, it's the research that gives me my ideas. And I don't know what I still have to learn. I'll find that out when I start writing again.
And do you have a plan on what you will be writing?
No, actually, I'm really letting myself take a break. I mean, there's lots of things that I still want, a lot of ideas I have, a lot of information I still have. Well, you know, maybe I want to write something different for change. I don't know. I'll see. You know, I'm just letting myself take a break. It's been a long time, 30 years in the process of getting those 6 books out.
That was Jean M. Owl. Jean will be appearing along with authors David Liss, Peter Likens, and Gail Lenz at the Tucson chapter of the Brandeis National Committee's 16th Annual Book and Author Luncheon, which happens on March 1st. Proceeds from this event will benefit Sustaining the Mind, a Brandeis National Committee fund that supports neuroscience research into Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and Lou Gehrig's disease, as well as providing science scholarships at Brandeis University. You can find more information on the Arizona Spotlight page at azpm.org. The Tucson chapter of the Brandeis National Committee is an underwriter of Arizona Public Media.